welcome to The Happy Writer. This is a podcast that aims to bring readers more books to enjoy and to help authors find more joy in their writing. I am your host, Marissa Meyer. Thank you for joining me. Holiday shopping has arrived. If you are not sure what you want to ask Santa for this year, I hope you might check out some of our Happy Writer podcast merchandise. I don't even know what there's notebooks and t-shirts and all sorts of fun things. You can find that on Etsy, Instagram, and TeePublic. Those links are in our Instagram profile, so I hope you'll check it out. One thing making me happy this week is that I decided to treat myself. I know you're supposed to wait for the holidays and let people buy you things, but I'm bad about that. When I want something, I just get it. So I decided to treat myself to some new bed linens. And I admit I am terrible about replacing things when they start to get worn out because, you know, you don't want to be wasteful. And if there's still life left in it, I'll like hang on as long as possible. So the old ones had been kicking around for a long time. The threads were starting to come out because the cats are always kneading on them. And like there was cat fur that you could never get out of it. And anyway, they were just getting really ratty. So I ordered some new soft sheets and a new duvet, which is like really fluffy. And it has been so luxurious. I never want to get out of bed now. I should be recording this from bed. There's an idea. And I've been spending mornings reading in bed. And this morning, Delaney even brought me my coffee. So I didn't even have to get up to get coffee. It's very perfect. I mean, it's just like a little paradise. Who knew new bed linens could bring this much joy? I am also so happy to be talking to today's guest. She's the author of Rebel Wing and its companion novel, Renegade Flight. Her newest sci-fi heist novel, Kingdom of Without, just came out last week. Please welcome Andrea Tang.
Thank you so much for having me on.
Oh, it is my absolute pleasure. Thank you for joining me. How are you feeling? The book just came out. Congratulations.
Good. Amazing. It's always a little surreal releasing a new book into the world, as I'm sure you know from having done it approximately 5 million times over. But it's always exciting every time.
It is exciting and it is surreal. I know for me, whenever like you receive the box of finished copies, there's always a moment where it's like, oh, how did this happen again?
Right. Yeah. It's like, I don't know. It's almost like, I don't have any kids, but I imagine it's a little bit like watching a kid grow up where you like, you open that box of finished author copies and you're like, when did this happen? I swear just yesterday you were a zero draft, but I still had like all of these markups that I needed to correct.
Oh, it's so true. And then you think back to how much it's changed over the writing process and the editing process. And you think back to some of your original ideas that in hindsight are really laughable, but at the time seemed so great. And yeah, it's a weird process.
Too real.
So Andrea, the first thing that I like to ask all of my guests is I want to hear your origin story. How did you become a writer?
So I think I became a writer the same way almost every writer does, which is that I started as a reader and essentially like found a way to like professionalize what was like my favorite childhood hobby, which was reading a lot. And then like eventually discovering that there are like adult people like behind the books that I was reading as a kid and wanting to be one of them when I grew up. So like I got really into writing as a direct result of like my reading habit as a kid. And one thing just kind of led to another.
Mm-hmm. So you loved reading and so did you know from fairly young that you wanted to be a writer?
I think I did. I've talked about this like a little bit in the past where like I knew from a pretty young age that I was like, all right, I want to be like one of those grown-ups with like their names on the like the title cover of these books that I love. But I also like I had the privilege / the curse of like knowing from a pretty young age also that like it may be that becoming like a professional author is not maybe the most financially stable occupation in the world. So I was aware of that from pretty early on. So I definitely like went to like university and like entered adult life with the understanding that I was going to like train for other professions and do other things as well, and like kind of set myself up to have a 9-to-5 and a life outside of writing. But for me, it was really just like kind of all about the discipline of like, you know, like taking the other work that I did seriously, but also just like keeping up with, you know, writing and practicing and developing craft and querying and failing and querying and drafting and just like going through that whole grindy cycle that we're all so fond of when we're first starting out.
Sure. Yeah. How many manuscripts do you think that you wrote before your first book?
Oh my gosh. I don't know. Are we counting the quote unquote like books that I wrote in middle school, which were literally like handwritten on pieces of craft paper and like stapled together? Because if so, like an infinite number.
It's uncountable. You know, I count all the things. All writing is practice. But for me, I'm thinking more like how many attempts at novels where you're thinking in your mind, this is going to be, you know, 250 plus pages and I'm going to try to get it published.
Right. If we're thinking like actual attempts at novels, like, you know, once I like developed a real understanding of the industry and what it would entail to query an agent and go through that whole process, I think I must have done, okay, now I'm like counting them in my head. I think there were at least like three, four or five, I think at least a couple of those might've been closer to novellas. And also I think like there were a couple of duds in there that I realized were duds like halfway through and then just like kind of like insisted on finishing anyway as a completionist. But I think maybe like, I would say probably like at least three or four like true attempts where I was like, okay, I could like try to maybe do something with this. So some decent practice rounds. Not as many as some of the authors that I've heard of. I have one friend who says that she did like, I think like upward of like 10 or 15. So yeah. My numbers are not quite that impressive. But I got a few respectable rounds in, I think.
Yeah, no, I think that's a pretty common story. And we get the whole spectrum here when I ask this question. Let's see, your first book was Rebel Wing. Is that right?
Yep, that is correct.
So was that the first book that you tried querying?
It was not. The first book that I tried querying was, oh gosh, this must have been, I think, like first year after finishing undergrad. It was like this sprawling young adult space opera that had way too much going on in it. Like in hindsight, looking back on that, I was like, that was a fun book. It was not right for the market at the time, but I was obsessed with it. I thought it was like the best thing since sliced bread when I was writing it, and I had a lot of fun. And hilariously, that book, when I queried it, my current agent, Tal, actually did, I think she asked me for either the full or the partial, and she did read a decent amount of it. And she sent me one of the like really nice, exciting rejections that you get at that stage, where she was like, well, I'm not going to rep this, but like, I do actually like your writing style. So if you want to come back to me with your other work somewhere down the line, I'd be happy to read it. And lo and behold, many years later, I went to her with what would eventually become Rebel Wing. So it kind of came full circle there.
I love that. It's so nice when agents are really encouraging. It's not totally the most common story.
Right.
And so then here we are. Okay, before we actually move on to talking about this. So you mentioned that first querying project was a kind of space opera. And I know you've written about Mecca. Why am I drawing a blank on that?
Yeah, you got it.
Thank you.
Yeah, no, I believe in you. You can do it.
And then this new book is very futuristic sci-fi. Has that always been the genre that you've been most drawn to? Or when in those early years, were you playing around with different genres too?
So I actually started as a fantasy girly, and I still kind of am at heart. And I think you can tell, like, even when you read my sci-fi, that most of it's not like Isaac Asimov style sci-fi, right? Like, it's very like soft. It's almost more like fantasy dressed up with sci-fi aesthetic. But I do really enjoy science fiction as kind of like a complement to fantasy. The two kind of go hand in hand for me personally. Mm-hmm. And yeah, no, it's interesting that like the first projects that like really just kind of sparked for me just happened to be sci-fi projects, even though I'd always thought of myself as more of a fantasy writer. But I'm really glad that I kind of got the chance to stretch my wings that way, because I do also love science fiction. I was a big like anime nerd as a kid. So I grew up watching a lot of like mecha shows with like the ones with like the giant robots and stuff. Mm-hmm. So you have an idea where some of the Rubble Wing inspiration came from.
Yeah, for sure. Yeah.
So, no, definitely.
No, and I love that description, the fantasy dressed up with a sci-fi aesthetic.
Right.
That rings so true. Because for me, I also always felt more like a fantasy writer. Mm-hmm. And then was like really shocked that the first book I managed to get published was sci-fi. And I was like, where did that come from?
Right. I was about to say, I feel like Lunar Chronicles definitely is very much that vibe where it's like, okay, this is technically kind of like cyberpunkish, sci-fi-ish, but like it has like a lot of fantasy energy.
Very much so. No, and I started just at some point calling it space opera because it's you're right. It's this other genre, this like mesh of the two.
Right. Which I love. I adore genre bending. I love like mashups, like the more creative you can get with the combination, the more I love it.
Yes, I love that too. And I love that young adult in particular seems very open to it. I know in
100%,
some other age groups, there's like a little bit more pushback when authors try to mix things up. But I think YA readers in particular are like, you know, bend all you want.
Definitely. I mean, that was kind of what drew me into writing young adult in the first place. Because like when I first started, all I knew was that I liked fantasy and science fiction. I didn't really care what age group I was writing for. I just knew that I liked like magic and dragons and adventures in space and all of that. And I think I fell into young adult in particular rather than I guess like straight adult SFF, because like at the time when I was coming into it, I just felt like so many young adult spec fic titles were doing really interesting things with genre that I just hadn't really seen anywhere else before. And granted, maybe that's because my reading was limited. I don't know. Mm-hmm. But just like as an anecdotal thing, I was like, I think a lot of the genre stuff that I'm finding myself most personally excited about that I think is kind of new and interesting is happening in YA, where I'm seeing a lot of like kind of like plot trope genre mishmash going on. And I really like that option to kind of break the rules a little bit in a fun way.
No, definitely. As a creative type, it's freeing to know that you don't have to be quite so stuck in what the marketing or the publishers or the gatekeepers are thinking is going to sell.
Right.
Okay. Well, I am so excited to talk about your new book that just came out last week. And I'll go ahead and mentioned, as I mentioned to you before we started the recording, I had so much fun reading this book because it does have a very similar vibe to the Lunar Chronicles. And so for me, it was such a nostalgic experience. Like it takes place in futuristic Beijing and our main character is a cyborg and there's a revolution brewing. And I was just like, oh, I feel like I'm having a homecoming right now. I loved it. And I hope that the Lunar Chronicles fans who are listening will pick it up because it really was a lot of fun.
Yeah. I mean, like I told you, that's such a high compliment coming from you as like the creator of Lunar Chronicles, just because like that was one of the early commercial comps like in-house when this project was being developed. So I was like, ah, yes, I have like the actual stamp of approval from Bruce Meyer herself. All right.
Gladly given. All right. Will you please tell listeners about your new novel, Kingdom of Without?
Yeah, gladly. So Kingdom of Without, I would definitely consider it an example of the genre mashup that we were talking about earlier, because it is at its core, it's a heist novel, but it is set against this futuristic cyberpunk backdrop, like you mentioned, in this like kind of like alternate version of Beijing. So the plot centers on this young girl, Ningar, who has grown up very poor in the sixth ring of Beijing. She, you know, she works as a bartender, but she like, you know, she also takes some gigs off books to make a living. She's done some burglary. She's been a thief. She's picked up some black market skills here and there. So she's almost like a little bit of a like kind of like young female Han Solo type. where it's like she's kind of legit, but not entirely. And she's running low on cash and is down on her luck when a friend of hers introduces her to an opportunity for a big score. The problem is it is an extremely illegal gig. It's like a big, big heist on a government property. And it's like of a scale she's never really encountered before, because it's not stealing an object this time, it's stealing a person. Because as it turns out, without spoiling too much, the gig is to break this former like revolutionary icon that everyone thought was dead, to like find her and like break her out of like the secret government prison that she's been kept in all this time. So that's how our heroine falls in with this like motley crew of like revolutionaries slash criminals to get this job done. And for her, again, like kind of like leading a bit on that Han Solo comp, for her, she's like, oh, it's just a job. It's just a job. I need my money. I need to make rent. Like, ah, ma, ma. But as we know, over time, as happens in stories like these, she does begin to develop, you know, soft, fluffy feelings towards her new colleagues and starts forming real friendships with them. So it is very much that kind of story.
Mm-hmm. One of those colleagues is like really ridiculously handsome.
Oh, naturally.
That's always the ridiculously handsome one.
You've got to have the ridiculously handsome one. It's like in our contract as writers that at least one character has to be like insanely hot.
Right? Why am I so attracted to this person that I swear I'm not going to fall for?
Right.
All right, let's talk about Ningar's character. You've touched on it a little bit. She's one of those characters that is so tough, so capable, and yet also has this like vulnerable inside that she fights so hard not to let it show. But of course, there are moments where she can't help it. Where did her character come from?
That's a good question. I think when I was sort of discovering her on the page, like, I don't know if this is how you write, but at least for me, I often have an idea of what a character is going to be like before I put pen to paper. And like, mostly I stay true to that vision, but I kind of like discover, I think, like the more complex aspects of their personalities through the process of writing and kind of like seeing the way they interact with like other characters on the page as I'm figuring out the story for myself. And so, but for Ningar, I think like I had like this basic sketch of her in my head, right? Where I'm like, oh yeah, she's a cat burglar. She's poor. She's down on her luck. She's probably going to be like a little gritty and rough around the edges. But of course, she has to have a tender side. Like we've seen this character before, like fairly common trope. But as I was writing her, I think I like kind of started delving into these nuances to her character, like the things that made her vulnerable, the like the weaknesses that she tends to have for like, you know, the fact that she did used to be a much more idealistic person. And all of those were kind of aspects of her that I sort of discovered alongside her like journey through the novel itself. And like another thing that I think I enjoyed about that process of figuring out her character as I was writing was that I think I realized that like a lot of like the tropes that she embodies are often kind of like typically masculine tropes that we see in fiction, where it's always like the kind of like rough around the edges anti-hero who like doesn't want to show that he has feelings and like doesn't like schmoop and doesn't, and you know, is all about the job. And like I think like especially in modern day, we're seeing more female characters like that. But when you first think of that character type, it is usually a dude. So it was kind of fun writing that archetype as a teenage girl. And I did just have a lot of fun with that.
Yeah. And I really, I don't want to say that like she has a great backstory, because she's got a horrible backstory.
Her backstory is very upsetting. It's not a backstory that anyone wants. It's very dark.
Yeah. But it's clear, and I don't know how much you want to give away of what her backstory is, but you can so clearly see how that also influenced who she became. Was that something that you kind of knew about her before you started writing, or did that develop alongside with writing the book?
So it was almost like her backstory was almost kind of a side note before I started writing, where I was like, okay, yeah, I know that I need this in order to make the plot work. and to make the character beats work. But I didn't really pay a ton of attention to it at the time because I was kind of like wrapped up in like, oh, how do heists work? I've never broken into anything in my life. How's this going to happen? And so I almost like forgot about it. And then I got to give credit to my editor, Eliza, who worked very closely with me on this manuscript for, I think, in like the first couple of drafts, like one of her big notes was like, you know, you're kind of dropping this thread about who, like where Ningar comes from, that she has this very complicated relationship with her father. And again, without spoiling too much, with, you know, like street drugs and with addiction issues in the family. And that that really is going to inform the way she reacts to the events of the plot as they unfold, because it's been such a formative thing for her. And like, you're kind of nodding to it, but I would really like to see you truly dive into that and let that breathe on the page. And I think until Eliza gave me that note, I had just been kind of like, okay, like checked it off. Like, you know, this thing happened in her past, moving off, blah, blah. But after talking to Eliza about it, I was like, you know what? You're right. This doesn't, like, something had felt kind of off about the way that I was writing Ningara up until that point, where I was like, I can't really put my finger on what feels off. I just know that something does. And after she gave me that note, I was like, I think that might be it. I think we might just need to let her backstory breathe a little bit more. Not like in the sense of like, oh, like every other paragraph, we're going to remind everybody about her childhood trauma, but just like kind of like getting into her head a bit and being like, okay, like how are the experiences that she's gone through in the past going to inform her reactions to the present? We don't necessarily have to explicitly put it on the page, but we can use it to like inform what does get put on the page, if that makes sense.
No, absolutely. And that makes me curious, because there is this thread that runs throughout the book and kind of ties a number of different elements of the plot together that has to do with addiction and has to do with the black market and some companies profiting from some people having these addictions. Was that did you draw on real life research for that, or were you just like very focused on Ningar and her reaction to this?
So I'd say a little from column A, a little from column B. Like initially that whole plot line was sort of like riffing off of like the real life like opium wars, essentially, as you know, like,
yeah, which feels very authentic.
Right, right. I was like, okay, it's a Beijing story. Like, it makes sense to kind of dive into that. But like, I do, like, I would not claim to myself to be a subject matter expert myself on like modern day politics surrounding things like the opioid crisis, for example. But I do have I'm fortunate that I do have a lot of friends who work in social services or in medical and social research, or are first responders who have had like much closer contact with those issues. Mm-hmm. But I spent a lot of time picking their brains. I spent a lot of time reading. We definitely used authenticity readers as well to dive into that kind of like more personal angle on the ways that the sort of macro political and social stuff affects the more micro stuff, like the interpersonal dynamics, and make sure that that was handled as appropriately as possible. So while I did draw on some background knowledge that I had of historical drug crises, because like one of my majors in undergrad was East Asian Civ, I have my master's degree in China studies. So that was something I had like the groundwork to kind of write about, but taking, I think, like crafting a more modern lens to it that was appropriately sensitive to a modern audience was something that I like definitely leaned a lot on much smarter people than me to pull off, for sure. And I'm like super, super grateful to all of them.
Yeah. I mean, I think that's just like a great strategy in general. Like, just lean on smarter people.
Definitely. Definitely.
So we talked about how this is sci-fi, fantasy adjacent, kind of space opera, kind of futuristic heist blending. Was there any question for you as you were writing or as you were developing the story as far as how sci-fi to make it? Like how far do you lean into the technology or expand the world building to include, you know, various sci-fi elements? Or was it just kind of like organic to what the story felt like it needed?
It was pretty organic, honestly. Like, I know that when I was kind of conceiving of it and like the general kind of like vibes and aesthetic of the world building with Eliza, we both, the two of us definitely agreed that like, you're like, all right, this is technically going to be shelved as sci-fi. It falls into the definition of cyberpunk, right? Which is a subcategory of science fiction. But like aesthetically, we almost want this to feel like a traditional like young adult high fantasy. Hence the title, hence the artwork that you see, the fact that you still are dealing with an imperial court and with royalty and all of that. So we didn't want to lean like into like super, super techie sci-fi. Like we wanted it to be like plausible. We didn't want to do anything that was too outlandish. There are a few early drafts that definitely had sci-fi elements in there that Eliza called out as like, okay, this is kind of stretching the realm of disbelief here.
I want to know what those were. What were the things that did not make the cut?
Oh gosh. I think one of them was like complacency, which is like the main street drug that's dealt with in the plot of Kingdom of Without. It just like, it already like does a lot of work. Like there's a lot that it does as like an addictive substance. And like, I think I just like gave it too much to do where it was like, it can do this. It can be, you know, it can be a stimulant, but it can also be used for torture and it can be used for this. And then like Eliza's like, this is too many
what
things.
What do you need it to do in the story today?
Right. It can do literally anything that the plot calls for. And Eliza was like, okay, no, we need to like either come up with like another drug or like another plot option or something. Cause you're beating this thing to death. Like it cannot do that much work for your plot. That was like one of the main cuts that was made. And I think was the right decision in the long run. But yeah, no, when we were plotting it out, we were like, yeah, we don't want to like, we want it to feel somewhat realistic, but we also don't want to lean too heavily into the tech side of sci-fi. Like we want it to be there, but we don't need like entire chapters on like how this particular piece of like android machinery works. We could just have androids on the page serving their plot purpose.
It's not what our readers are here for.
Right.
All right. I want to talk characters because this is one of those, I mean, as so many great heist books are, we've got this wonderful hodgepodge. I think you called them a motley crew, you know, the one that deals with explosives and the one that's the medic. But they're all just kind of thrown together and now have to complete this seemingly impossible task. And I love stories like this. I love it when we see a really fun mix of characters having to work together. And then, of course, we've got Ningar as our fish out of water coming into it, trying to figure out where she fits in. So just generally speaking, when it comes to developing these more side characters, How do you go about doing that in trying to make sure that each one feels, you know, authentic and like a full character, but is still interesting and unique and all of that? Just kind of what's your thought process?
I think especially what I discovered with writing a true ensemble cast really for arguably the first time, because Rebel Wing and like Renegade Flight, its companion novel, both kind of had ensemble casts, but like they didn't have to like work in lockstep quite as much as like a literal heist crew would have to. So there's a lot of scenes where there's just a lot of people on the page and they're all doing a lot of different things. And so what I discovered is that it's challenging to track the movements of so many different people in the same scene. And you have to do that like scene after scene after scene. And so for me, I think the overarching theme of my process was like, make sure that these people are all distinguishable from one another, which means that they all need to have very distinct personalities, motivations, backstories, their histories with each other don't necessarily have to come out super explicitly on the page, but they should kind of inform the way that they're interacting. Because I feel like if I don't keep that in mind, what I end up with are like five like witty, fun talking heads, but they could all literally just be interchanged with each other. Mm-hmm. And that's not fun, right?
Right.
Like, you want them to feel like five real people. You want it to feel like a room full of like, almost like a room at a party with people that you actually know. So I think like that was really the most important task for me when I was coming up with the supporting cast.
Yeah. So do you, you know, you've got these, let's say five characters. Do you like think in terms of archetypes? Like, okay, who's going to be the sassy one? Who's going to be the smart one? Or like how do you go about giving them distinct personalities?
So I actually kind of let the primary characters almost inform what I needed out of the secondary characters. So like Ningar and our male lead, Chungyun, both have particular personalities, right? Where like she's this kind of like rough around the edges, like street kid. He's like, a much more kind of like stiff upper lip type, who's very serious and has always been kind of groomed for leadership. And so when I was filling out the supporting cast, I wanted personalities that would really contrast theirs. So we have some characters that are a little bit more laid back, for example, who seem very laissez-faire, except when it's time to get down to business. We also have characters that are like not like rough around the edges so much and like not stiff upper lip necessarily, but are like, I'm thinking of Feifei here, for example, our medic, who's just like very like sensible, like almost aggressively so, where she's almost like kind of team mom in that she's always like kind of like gently pointing out like the logical flaws in the plan, like not in like a mean way, but just kind of in a, hey, I kind of want to keep you all pieced together, literally. And so I was like, okay, yeah, you need somebody who's going to be like the sensible one who kind of keeps them all in line. You need somebody who's a little bit more laid back. You need somebody who's like, because they're all very young, we have like an older character to be who's like seen a lot more than they have, who can kind of be the voice of more informed reason and has a more fully developed prefrontal cortex, which I'm sure is helpful. So I think like the personalities and like the individual traits of my secondary cast kind of came together as a like, okay, what traits do I need in people to like effectively balance out these like very strong personalities that like my protagonists have?
Mm-hmm. All right. Well, let's talk a little bit more about those protagonists then, because we've hardly touched on the romance, but it's a really fun romance.
It is such a fun romance. I loved writing the romance.
I bet. So what was it that you loved about writing this romance?
I really liked that like, I think I've talked a little bit about gender role reversal previously, but like, I really liked that, like, despite the fact that like, Chungyun, our male lead, is a very like take charge, knows what he's about, like leader type. When he interacts with Ningar, he doesn't quite know what to do with her. And she kind of ends up being the aggressor and like the kind of like the more experienced of the two when it comes to like, you know, matters of the heart and like dating and hookup culture and all of that. And he's like almost, despite knowing so much more than she does about politics and about this entire heist plot and being like genuinely brilliant in his own way, when it comes to stuff like picking up girls at a bar, he's kind of clueless. And I really enjoyed writing that contrast where it was like the heroine who kind of got to be the experienced one who's like, oh, sweet summer child, let me show you the way, you poor ingenue, you.
No, I adored that too. He is so sweet. I mean, he really is just adorably clueless sometimes. I did have this moment where there's a scene that utilizes the one bed trope,
yes.
Which is like, of course, one of like my favorite tropes because it's so great. And I had this moment of thinking like, I wonder if Andrea wrote this entire book just so she could have this one bed scene.
I will neither confirm nor deny, but it was one of my favorite scenes to write. I will leave you with that.
Yeah, it's a great scene. It's a great moment. So we haven't hardly gotten into talking at all about the heist yet. Challenges of writing a heist, fun things about writing a heist. Is this your first heist book?
It is my first heist book. As it turns out, heists are really hard to write.
I have heard this from a number of people, as a matter of fact.
I think we all read Six of Crows and were like, oh, he should write stuff like,
can do it?
It's like, no. Yeah, like this no, seems but he like
can do
fun.
It like Leigh Bardugo can do it.
No, no. And like, if you like listen to her interviews or like read through like what she's written about that process, even she's like, yeah, writing a heist is hard. Don't do it.
Yeah.
Like,
yeah, no, I actually, I'll just throw out a quick advertisement. She was on the podcast. It's been a couple years now. And I remember like a moment we were talking about writing heists. And I was like, how often did you regret your life choices? And she was like, every day.
Yep. That does make me feel better because similarly was just like, oh, this, I might have bitten off a little more than I can chew. All right, let's go. We've made our bed. Now we got to lie in it. Let's see where we can go from here.
Yeah. So how did you end up pulling it off?
So I think I've kind of had to like, this might end up being a controversial statement. Sorry, people. I think I've had to like give myself permission to be okay with the fact that I was like writing a fictional heist in like a speculative world. So I didn't have to like know everything about how like an actual break-in would work necessarily. Like I could fudge a little bit. I could, instead of doing a ton of research on how to like break into like a secret government facility, which for one thing, I'm like, I don't know if I want that in my search history. For another, I was also kind of like, well, I mean, at the end of the day, we kind of want to, what we put on the page is there to kind of move this plot along and to kind of entertain the readers, right? So we don't necessarily need to fall deeply in love with our own research. We just need to get enough in there to like make sense for the characters and make sense to the audience. So in that sense, I took a lot more cues from heist fiction than from actual real life heists. So like obviously like I was one of billions of people who had read Six of Crows. I had also read Lies of La Camorra. I had of course seen like the Ocean's movies. I read Grace Lee's Portrait of a Thief, which is a contemporary heist. That was a lot of fun as well. Yeah, so I think I almost, like, it was less studying how, like, actual heist crime works and more studying how a heist plot works. Kind of the way, like I've also written a murder mystery, for example. It was less like, how would I actually murder somebody? And more like, what does the structure of a good whodunit look like? And what are the elements that you need to pull off? And that was kind of how I treated my heist plot.
Yeah, that's very logical and very practical. I'm struggling to remember. There was another author that I talked to a while back who had also written a heist book, and this is going to drive me nuts until I can remember who it was. But I specifically remember them saying about how, like, yeah, it's difficult to come up with like the plan of the heist and how the characters are going to go about doing it. But on the flip side, I also get to come up with the security system.
Right.
And the thing it is that they're trying to accomplish. So you can devise it in a way that you can make it work.
Absolutely. Yeah. Like, because yeah, like I kind of like, yeah, no, I agree with that 100% because like part of what made this whole thing doable was that I could kind of like design a puzzle that was a solvable puzzle. Right. Mm-hmm. Like I have the cheat code to the Rubik's Cube. So I could kind of like work from the ground up in that sense.
Right. No, that makes so much sense. Did you ever feel like you'd written yourself into a corner that you had trouble getting out of?
A little bit here and there. Again, I have a really good editor. She was there to rescue me a few times when I was like, what did I do with this? I think I tried to get, I definitely tried to slide a few fast ones on her where I was like, this doesn't really make sense and probably wouldn't work in a heist, but I'm just going to hand wave it with some like funky sci-fi world building and it'll be fine. And then she got the draft and she was like, it's not fine, Andrea, please fix it. And then I did. So.
I love that. I love those moments. And I feel like they happen with every book where you're like, no one will notice this one. No,
yep.
The editor always notices.
every time, but we love them for it.
So. No, truly. And then you know that like, yeah, it was so worth it to go in and make that better.
Yeah, exactly.
All right. Last question before our bonus round. The holidays are just around the corner. What's on your writing wish list?
On my writing wish list? Oh, gosh. Writing, not reading, right?
I mean, you can interpret that question how you want to, I suppose.
Okay, if we're thinking just right, I mean, I feel like it's too easy of a question if we allow for reading, because I'm like, oh, here's like a giant list of books that I want to read.
I would just like $1,000 bookstore gift card.
There you go. Yeah, business expense technically. But like writing wise, I don't know. I have yet to use Scrivener, and I've heard its praises sung for so long that I'm like, I kind of want to try it. But I'm also like kind of a Luddite, and I'm like sufficiently afraid of new technology that I'm like, what if I spend money on this and I hate it and don't know how to use it? But if someone gifted it to me, I would use it, because I'd be like, all right, no harm, no foul. Well, we can, you know, risk-free trial. Let's do this.
I like it. No, that makes sense. I am an advocate. I have used Scrivener for 10 years and I can't imagine ever going back to Word.
Oh, okay. All right. We have a full-on testimonial then. I like that.
Yep. Yep. No, absolutely. I really love it. But I also understand that like you have a process and it works, and it can be like intimidating to shake things up sometimes.
Right. Right. Definitely. Definitely. But yeah, I'm always like, yeah, like I, like as professionals, I think we are always kind of trying to think about like, okay, what are the tools that I could use to do my job better? In the same way that like, you know, as writers, we're also readers. We're always thinking of like reading to the market, being like, okay, I kind of want to keep up with what's going on in the genres that I'm writing, or even in genres outside of what we're writing. Like, I just want to like, in addition to like being a voracious reader who loves stories, it's like, all right, we want to keep our fingers on like the pulse of what's going on in our own industry. I think like there is also this onus to be like, all right, like, what can I do to make my life as a writer, as a professional in this industry, just a little bit easier? And it sounds like Scrivener might be one of those things.
Yeah, no, I totally think it makes my life easier. For me, like one of the biggest features over just like a basic word processor is that I always have to move chapters around. Like my plots change so much that I always am reshuffling and reordering things.
Oh, that's true. I do a lot of cut and paste.
Yeah, cutting and pasting is such a headache. And in Scrivener, it's just a click and drag. It's so easy.
All right. You are kind of selling me on this now.
You're welcome. Merry Christmas.
Thank you. Thank you.
All right. Are you ready for our bonus round?
I am. I am.
What book makes you happy?
Oh, there are so many of those. Most recently, I've been reading Victoria Lee's A Shot in the Dark, which I've really been enjoying. It's like, it is Victoria's first contemporary, and it's like this delightful queer romance. That's just like, and it's like, I think it's also her first adult novel. And like, it's so outside of what I would normally read or write that I'm just like finding so much joy in like discovering something new. And because it's a romance, like, you know that it's like, it's going to have a feel good ending despite the turmoil that she is putting the characters through at present where I am. Mm-hmm. So like, even as I am suffering, there is joy in the suffering, like knowing that I am earning my happy ending. So definitely recommend Shot in the Dark. Really fun characters, really tremendous author. So yeah, that is the answer I'm going to give, because it's like on my bedside table right now.
What are you working on next?
So I have a fantasy murder mystery called These Deadly Prophecies, which technically I finished working on. It is out in early February. So that's going to be next on the agenda in terms of what I'm working on, in terms of promoting and getting in front of readers and talking about. But if we're talking about what I'm working on as like a project that I'm currently writing, I have a couple of like semi-secret projects. There's one that like I can't talk about right now, but it's probably going to be my fifth novel. It's going to be another fantasy. And all I will say about it is that it concerns dueling magicians. So that'll be fun.
That does sound fun.
Yeah, I'm really excited about that one.
That sounds difficult, like a heist again.
I think every time I write something new, I like pick the most difficult plot structure imaginable. And I'm like, this will be different from last time.
Heist, magicians, yeah.
Right. And that one's kind of fun because it's almost like it, like, because it concerns like a dueling circuit. And because I'm like a combat sports athlete, I'm like, oh, I can kind of treat this almost a little bit like a sports novel, but it's fantasy. So I think that one is going to be a lot of fun. That is all I can really say on that matter for the moment. But I'm also like looking into maybe writing a little bit of adult, a little bit of middle grade. So we'll see where the tide takes us.
Awesome. And lastly, where can people find you?
So my primary social media platform these days is Instagram. You can find me under the handle atangwrites. That's A-T-A-N-G, writes, W-R-I-T-E-S. And I have the same social media handle on like every platform. So I'm also there, like it's the same handle on Twitter, even though I'm not super active on Twitter these days, like many writers in the, like after, you know, it Twitter turned into X and everything got super confusing. But yeah, but you can still find me there. But I think your best bet of getting hold of me is probably via Instagram. And you can also find me at my author website at AndreaTangWrites.com.
Awesome. Andrea, thank you so much for joining me.
Thank you so much for having me. This was so much fun.
Readers, I hope you will check out Kingdom of Without. I especially recommend it for you Lunar Chronicles fans who are in need of more cyborgs and revolutions in your life. Of course, we encourage you to support your local indie bookstore if you can. If you don't have a local indie, you can check out our affiliate store at bookshop.org/shop/Marissa Meyer. Next week, we will be having our very last episode of the year. I cannot wait to talk to Elle Gonzalez-Rose about her very charming contemporary YA, Caught in a Bad Fomance. And yes, I had Lady Gaga in my head the whole time I was reading this book. If you're enjoying these conversations, please subscribe and follow us on Instagram at Marissa Meyer Author and at Happy Writer Podcast. Until next time, stay inspired, keep writing, and whatever life throws at you today, I hope that now you're feeling a little bit happier.